This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
There you are. Welcome back. Hey, it's your host, Kevin Pollack, a.k.a. Moish Mazel. I have such a wonderful guest today. I'm so excited for you, as I was for me when Jason Alexander and I recorded what is now a three-parter. Oh, we went on and on. Yeah, so this is part one, which will end oddly. Hopefully you'll understand the cliffhanger moment I chose, and you'll appreciate it, rather. Yeah, I hope that. This is a great conversation that Jason, we've known each other a long time. A storied history that comes up, I believe, during the interview. Maybe part two. Yeah, I'm very excited. And I'll be reading one of your emails later, of course. Thank you again for writing to my Mrs. Mazel Pod at gmail.com. Did you know that's how you get a hold? Are you new to the podcast? Hey, I'm sorry. I left out all the greetings to the new listeners. Hello, new listener. How are you? How'd you find out about us? Would you write to me at my Mrs. Mazel Pod at gmail.com and let me know? Yeah, and then tell everyone you've ever met. Thank you for that. Here's part one of my conversation with Jason Alexander as we begin in this episode to break down season four of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, episode... I want to say four. Does that make sense? Yeah. When I don't have it directly in front of me, folks, it's very easy to get confused. But now I've just checked. I've stalled long enough. Forgive me. And it is, in fact, season four, episode four. Enjoy. And now, ladies and Jews, here is Mr. Jason Alexander. Now, Jason...
Is that the audience makeup, by the way, ladies and Jews?
Yeah. Yeah, no.
That's the whole fan base for the Mazel show, I would imagine.
Ladies and Jews, you'd be surprised. First question is, how are you?
I'm good. I am stupidly good. You and I both have the blessings. We have colleagues that are suffering horribly, and yet everything is good. I've got stuff going on. I've got gigs. I've got jobs. I've got a grandchild. I've got a healthy family. Everybody's good.
And I think it's important to give thanks for all these things.
It's amazing. Daily. The last thing I do before I go to bed, I have one of those. You ever see these books? It's one line a day for 5 years.
No.
Oh yeah. They have them all over any stationery store. So it's a tiny little book. It's about the size of two cell phones, and there's like four lines for every day, and for 5 years you have one page is 5 years of one day. And you write every day, just something at the end of the day to note your day. And at the end of 5 years, you have a tiny little diary of events or thoughts or whatever it is. And I find every day, it's the last thing I do before I go to bed. Every day is like, Who do I thank? How do I? Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
This makes no sense. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So rather than trying to make sense of it, let's just give thanks.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And so at the end of the year, you have what from this notebook thing?
Well, what's really interesting is that when you turn a page, you know, when you've used the book for 5 years, every single page, like October 3rd, you have 5 years of October 3rds. And it's really easy at a glance to go, huh, look what I was thinking about noting 5 years ago on this day, as opposed to now. And because you have very little space in which to note anything, you really do think about it for a second about what's worth noting about today.
Right.
And it's fascinating. And there are themes. There are definite themes that I see. Half of it is, you know, politics is going to destroy the world.
Yeah.
The other half is, why can't I lose a friggin' pound?
And then every February 2nd.
Yeah, exactly.
Each year, something similar.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you for all of that. And thank you for being here. I, too, am exceptionally grateful. The way I'd like to start, if you don't mind, is just your entree into the Marvel Universe. How the hell, what exactly went down?
Very good question. I actually think, if I had to guess, I think that...
As opposed to remember?
Yeah, well, yeah. What I think happened, I'm just going to think it through for one more second to make sure I am not wrong.
Maybe go back to the book at the bedside table.
Yeah, no. So I had become such a fan. It was one of those shows where Dana and my wife, Dana and I, from the get-go.
Yeah.
We had been watching and loving it. And that doesn't usually happen for me. Usually I have to warm into a show, but right from episode one, we were like, oh, this is good.
Yeah.
Not only good, but as I'm sure you know, you guys were spending stupid amounts of money, you know, and it was all up on the screen.
All of it had, you know, full disclosure, all the money we spent on a daily basis had just fallen out of Bezos' pocket. So it's not like...
Exactly. So my manager somehow knew either Dan or Amy from years ago.
Ah.
And found a contact number and said, look, you know, we don't know if you're doing guest stars or if you want, you know, recognizable people. But if there's ever any reason that you might want Jason to come do the show, he loves the show. I'd be thrilled to do it. And that was it. And about a year later, we got a call that said, would he come do this? And actually, I almost blew it because I guess it was season three was my first episode. And I was in Greece when the call came in to come go to Miami to do this thing. And I went, I can't do it. I'm in Greece. I can't do it. We rejigged the Greece trip a little bit.
Well, let me qualify for the listener. You were in the road company of Greece in Poughkeepsie. When you say I was in Greece,
how wrong you are. Oh, I was actually in Zakynthos Island when that call came in.
With your whole family.
And I thought, well, can I turn this down and they'll come back to me?
Right.
And the word on the street was, don't turn it down. They don't come back, so don't turn it down.
They hold grudges?
Well, not they hold grudges, but, you know, when they make an offer, it's because they really have an inspiration for what they want to do. And if that's not it, they may not get inspired again. So,
and it turns out from what we see of you in the show, it was a very specific role.
Yeah, very specific. And smart of them. I don't know if they knew that Tony and I had been chums and that we had worked together before, but that was, considering everybody was literally in that season three show, a little bit of a fish out of water. You weren't filming at home base. We're down in Miami Beach. Everything was new. In that season, that being my really one episode, was just with Tony. I didn't work with anybody else in the cast. And it was so comfortable and so easy. And I feel like you got a history from us because we had a little bit of history. You know, if I had met him for the first time, I think that scene would have played a little differently than it did. But
Oh yeah, and nice. It comes across. It definitely reads the camaraderie, the history that you can act and portray, but it does absolutely help to if it comes from a place of reality. Now, you also had in that scene what I like to call the Archie Comics moment or day. One of the things that hooked me into Archie Comics was that they would sometimes or all the time have school on the beach. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, that was incredibly challenging. You know, I'd never understood that before because the only time I had ever shot anything on any kind of water was the very first movie I did when I was 18 or 19 years old. We shot something on a lake and I had no memory of it being particularly more difficult. But just to get, in the final edit of the episode, it's a lot of what we did is cut short because we never really got it. The ocean just was not cooperating. And that was a huge setup with the camera that could go under the water, come out of the water, follow us up the beach. But we kept trying to hold a relative mark in the water,
right?
You know, and between roll and action, we had drifted 15 feet out of the way. So it was just
every time
it was really, really tricky. And Amy was determined to get it. And we spent a great deal of time trying to get it. And then, of course, the minute she went, nah, screw it, let's go get the big scene on the beach, the rain came in. Yep. It was a very tricky day, but boy,
it was Miami.
It was a testament. I'm sure you picked up some additional Miami crew, but it was a testament to your crew and to Amy and to everybody. Nobody's tempers got crazy. Nobody lost their cool. Nobody lost the mission. Nobody sacrificed anything. They just put their heads down and went, okay, how do we do this given the conditions we now have? And it was fantastic.
Yeah. And I'm sure when you watched that episode, what is it like for you? Because every actor is a little different on watching themselves.
Yeah.
Are you hypercritical? Do you see what the rest of us see? Do you only see?
Kev, I don't know. I tend to dissociate when I watch myself. Back.
Same here.
I tend to go, oh, he was good there, or he missed that, or you know, yeah. Always on like a feature, when I see the finished product, I any given scene, I go, oh, that was the first week. That was the first week. I didn't know what I was doing.
You know,
I can see the learning curve. I can see how you settle into it as the shooting goes on.
Interesting.
But what I loved. There were two things about the scene on the beach. One was lovely, and the other one was I got a lot of calls from people because it was really not a comedy scene. It was a very heartfelt scene, and it asked me to do some work that I hadn't been asked to do in a while, and I was a little, you know, you always, it's a muscle, and you go, oh, boy, I hope it hasn't atrophied. And it came out beautifully. And I got a lot of calls from people going, that was such rich, beautiful, wonderful work. I love the texture, the writing, the history of the character expressed in really very concise way. It was just beautiful economic writing. So there was a lot of accolades. And I went, huh, okay, well, yeah, I guess I shouldn't be afraid to use those muscles. And then the other thing that people would say, because I begin that scene in a bathing suit, and then it becomes a bathing suit and a cabana jacket. And a lot of my friends would say, you're so brave. You're so brave. And I went, yeah, I gotta see if I can get back on that Pritikin thing. It was, you know, that's always the thing is I look in the mirror sometimes and I go, hey, you're doing okay. 64 years old, you're looking pretty good. You're strong, you're healthy. And then I see myself on film and go, holy shit, Jesus, have a locale, you know.
Why would the camera put all those 10 pounds on?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And how did it know where to put them? But also, I learned long ago, the moment someone funny is more focused on how they look, or as opposed to what is the work.
Yeah,
they're in trouble.
Yeah. In fact, that is my one of the reasons I feel I'm not a terribly good film actor. I have two things. One is I do have a directorial eye on myself, being sometimes an actor, sometimes a director. I always have that, the teacher's eye because I teach, and the director's eye because I direct. It's always going, are you doing it? Are you doing what you said you're going to do? Are you really doing it? You know, and that voice is going. And I also, and you must have much less of an issue with this, I'm always very aware of that camera. It's like, I keep going, why is this thing getting away from me? Unless it's, you know, Seinfeld was great because they were
way back
15 feet away and there was a wall of them and we just treated it like a theater piece. But when the camera gets in there and shares the space with me, I'm always kind of aware that there's somebody right on my peripheral that I'm supposed to ignore and pretend isn't there. And if I'm doing something, if I was doing a film, I'm sure, and that's what I mean about I can always spot what I was doing the first week, the second week, the third week. By the second week, I start to be able to forget that machine. But for the first couple of days, it's really hard. And when I do guest spots, you know, everything is so you're a guest in someone else's house. So everything is new. The tempo of the show, the actors have their own groove, the regular actors have their own groove. There's a rapport between the directors and the cast. I'm not quite in that yet, in the crew. And then the machinery comes in. So, you know, they go, action. And I go, just get in your own skin, for God's sake. Just try and do that, you know. So it's not that I'm overly critical, but I do see. And when I teach actors, I teach them a mantra that I think is really important. And I do live by it. And the mantra goes something like this. On that day, at that moment, being who I am and knowing what I know, that was the best I could do. Doesn't mean that 5 minutes later I wouldn't have done something much better, but that's when I had to do it. And I put everything I could think of there at that moment, good, bad, or indifferent. And I go, okay, that's your little pin in the map of your timeline. That was who you were and where you were at that moment. So I tend to be forgiving but critical.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's a great mantra and a good place to begin and finish when it comes to forgiving what it might be later.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Be as present as possible when you're doing it. But then, yeah, that's what that was.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And do you find that for yourself? Are you able to?
I go the other way. Everything I've ever done plays on a continuous loop on 7 different screens throughout my house. I cannot get enough.
That's great. I think that's really healthy.
Well, sure. If you go to narcissist camp, it's incredibly healthy.
But does that also translate into your comfort level with those cameras? That you're just immediately comfortable?
I can only watch myself in anything if I'm alone. If I'm with one other person.
I hear you.
Then it's uncomfortable. Or I'm at, you know, if I'm at a screening or a premiere, I remember when I was at a premiere of something I directed, I was more in tune to the audience and their appreciation of nuances that I was too in love with, right? And here comes this moment. Oh, they missed it. And then if I'm acting in something and I'm at a premiere, I'm probably scrutinizing the director's decisions in editing. Sure. More than I am my own performance.
I hear you.
Oh, I remember Barry Levinson's Avalon, which was kind of the kickoff for me in terms of being a so-called dramatic actor. You know, my dream from coming out of stand-up was when I saw Michael Keaton in Night Shift and said, okay, that's what I could do. I could do that. Like as a stand-up with no formal training as an actor, I could certainly do. So that was the plan, get myself one of those. And then Avalon came along and, you know, Barry came from stand-up and, he has a stand up in almost every one of his movies, and he doesn't believe in rehearsal at all. All the actors on Avalon came from theater other than me, and they all wanted to rehearse. And he said, no, 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 you can go to lunch. You can get, hang out together, but no, no rehearsal. He really loves everything in the moment.
Yeah.
And spontaneity. And so, yeah, I remember that Keys to the Castle sort of thing, and where that movie, I was allowed to do, just be natural in front of the camera, not have to do anything. And yeah, thankfully that was my entree, because God, imagine coming from working with a director who wanted me to just emote as opposed to be. And so I learned organically to be loose and natural in front of those machines, as you call them, and not, not think about anything else.
That's so good.
Yeah. But that was the one where, when it came out, people asked my then wife, where did he train in New York? Because they were all convinced I was this dramatic actor. We would laugh ourselves sick. So I asked you, well, first of all, you said Amy directed that first episode you were in. Before we go,
Amy directed, was the primary director on both of my episodes.
Uh-huh.
Dan directed a phone call sequence that I had with Tony.
Oh, right.
For one of the episodes. So I got to have them both at the helm, but Amy was primarily the director on both of my episodes.
Yeah. And how did you find her in terms of a coworker, a team leader?
She,
the one with everything in her head.
Yeah. What I loved about her was her attitude, which was welcoming and confident.
Yeah.
And happy you were there. I mean, she was a great cheerleader.
Yeah.
She knew what she wanted to do. Absolutely knew what she wanted to do.
Yeah. Did you get many performance notes after a take?
Yes, not many, but succinct and smart.
Were the notes?
There were things like in the big scene with Tony in the cabana. There's a lot of feeling going on in that scene. Some of it is being, is trying to be contained. Some of it slips out. You know, there's a range of possibility. And like I say, having not used those muscles for a while and being the new guy on the set, you're a little uncertain of how it's going to play, what's going to play, what's right, what's wrong for this show.
Right.
And I would do two takes, and she'd go, have it, you're good, have it, you know. So she could see I was leaning on it a little bit to know if it was playing. And my thing also when I teach is I'm very concerned about, am I offering my partner something? Am I giving them an opportunity, especially if they're the relatively silent one in the scene? Am I giving them something to live on and to offer back? So I tend to be a little more demonstrative, a little more animated, especially in my earlier takes, because I'm offering stuff up for possibility. And she was great. She just said, yeah, just have it. We're getting it all. So take your time, breathe.
She wasn't saying we have what we need when she said have.
No, she was saying we're getting what you want us to get. You don't have to work hard on it. Trust us. We see what you want us to see, is what she was saying, which I really appreciated. And then there were some pacing notes, and there was,
that's the big one for all.
That's always the big one, because initially, I think I was pushing tempo, and she went, just breathe. It's okay. Take your time. Let's find it. And then once we were in that groove, of course, it starts to get a little indulgent. she would go, okay, let's pick it up. And I think if I remember correctly, there were one or two moments where, in essence, she would say, you don't need that beat. It's okay. Just, you don't need it. Just move through it.
Yeah.
But what was great about it, well, first of all, you've got an auteur. You've got the woman who wrote it is also the woman directing it. So she knows what her intention was. She knows what the event of the scene is. Yeah. She's got a lot of faith in your ability to deliver it. And so she needs very little. She has to guide very little.
Yeah.
She's succinct.
She casts very well. She really does. And by that, I mean, let's see, I know what I want in Asher. I know the kind of energy and nuance at the same time and depth. And then she goes into the fan base that she has in her head of all the actors, because she loves actors and loves the theater.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So when you pop up into gotta have him or them or they, she's already done the directing in a weird way. She already, okay, well, this person, because so many of us, the majority of the notes we ever got was just base it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. There was very, very few times for me that either of them said, I need less or more. It was just, yeah. So I'm always curious, and your insights are kind of exceptional, because most people, when answering the question, don't go into as much detail. So thank you for that in terms actual conversation with her.
I'll say one more thing about,
please.
I know we're ostensibly focusing on the season 4 episode, but the other thing about the one on the beach, which I think was interesting for the show as well, is that unlike so much of the Maisel shows where there is incredible movement, these two guys sitting side by side in beach chairs. And it was just a very different scene. I think for her as well, it was a very different scene. It just used a different set of tools from her tool belt about how does she want to get this? What does she want to do with it? What does she want this event, which is a very quiet thing, to be? And how does she get her two guys to make that event with her? I have to say, of all the people who have said action and cut to me, she was absolutely among the clearest and most collaborative that I've come across.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. Well, let's jump into season 4, episode 4. It's called Interesting People on Christopher Street, and man, oh man.
Yeah.
In DDO.
Yeah.
But the episode opens. I'm going to have David Mullen, our cinematographer, award-winning, on in a couple days. And I cannot wait to talk to him about the Wilford Theater. So you talk about money falling out of Bezos' pocket.
Oh, my God.
I had heard they spent a couple million on building that theater. And that theater, for folks listening who don't know yet, was built on a sound stage. Every part of it, any exterior that might have been used for it was picked up, obviously, at an actual location. But the interior, the backstage, balcony, everything. They built seats as if, I mean, they built a theater.
You're actually blowing me away, because I didn't know it was a set.
Yeah.
I thought you guys found a theater. And that is mind-boggling.
Right?
But I've come to, you know, I've come with the Maisel show to go, I shouldn't be mind-boggled by that, because that's the kind of crap you guys were able to do, for whatever reason, was to not only build that stuff, but to build it to that degree of
attention to detail.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And that's in terms of the for whatever reason, end quote, you know, massive worldwide success. That's the only reason.
Yeah.
You know from the ins and outs of all of this over our lives. In success comes more opportunity and not just spoil. So Amy and Dan were given marching orders from pilot to series when it was picked up for 2 seasons. And even on the pilot, their marching orders were make it look like a movie.
Yeah.
We love your script. Make it look like a movie. And then every week when it was picked up to series, just make it look like a movie. That's our note. And then once the first season came out and the world reacted the way it did, and Emmys poured in, what have you, it was just more freedom to follow their vision. And that included drilling down on building the Wolford Theater. To me, that became the example of, oh, this is what you can do with a 63,000 square foot soundstage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I once asked Amy in the down moment, because, you know, I've done a little bit of producing. I said, do you mind me asking what your typical budget is per episode? And she said, you know, it's never really come up.
By the way, she wasn't saying anything or avoiding anything that wasn't the truth.
Yeah. No, I think she was being totally genuine. She went, yes, you know, I could estimate what it is, but.
Yeah, we had a non-creative producer, Dana Gilbert, genius, who could tell you to the penny.
Yeah.
And the creative showrunners, it never came up. Yeah.
Astonishing.
Yeah. So episode 4 of season 4 begins on the Wilford Theater. Cue telephone. Can you hear that in the background?
I don't. You don't hear the leaf blowers and the nail gun. I don't hear the telephone.
Wow, we have great microphones.
Yeah.
I'm using the Shure M7 or the M4.
I also have a Shure something 8. I don't know what it means.
Oh, he's got the 8. He's got the 8, people.
Yeah.
Well, those of you that can hear the phone in the background of my microphone, you're welcome. The Wilford Theater, it opens up on the dancers on stage in a line displaying the various outfits and all the various use of color. And you talk about eye candy. That is just, right? Isn't it crazy?
It is stunning.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. But even more so, I mean, I'm sitting here nonchalant, but I'm even more gobsmacked because it's a set. It's something they built.
Right.
And I thought they just found something downtown and dressed it. And that would have been impressive, but to know that they pulled it from nothing. It's just impressive.
Creating the lighting scheme of a theater.
Yeah.
And it's also
very hard to get theater on film.
Yeah.
You know, to smell it, and she got it. I mean, you think you're in a theater. You really feel it. I mean, I think the last guy who did that was Fosse in Cabaret, where you really went, I feel like I'm in there, but it's extraordinary.
Her and the team leaders, Bill Groom and production design, and David Mullen, of course, the cinematographer, and every department on the show, they just went around and gathered savants, basically. I've said it before, and it's never been more evident than in this opening.
You know what else I admire about the show, and it's exemplified in that scene, is here you have, you know, basically Minsky's. You've got this burlesque club, and you've got women of all kinds of body shapes and types on that stage. They're all fabulous. And you need to suggest a casualness about nudity in that environment. Mm. And yet it is done. I am one of those guys. I tend to hate nudity on film, because I immediately go to the performers going, that they really have to do this.
Yep.
They really need to do it. And everything about it is done with such class and so beautifully and with such integrity that not for one second did I actually stop and think about the actresses and how they might be experiencing this. It just was flawless.
It was
gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous.
But that's an interesting takeaway, that it was so compelling and involving.
Yeah.
All those thoughts. Yeah. And I don't want to leave out Donna. on the wardrobe of these dancers. I mean, it's just, again, going back to what you can do with a bottomless pit of money. But you do need that savant genius as well to spend that money building clothing. And then we're on to the inner workings of this glorious theater. As I mentioned, they built all the backstage stuff, the dressing rooms, man. The hallways. It's all built. And you're right, you would never know. And I love the opening here. We're establishing that Midge has an issue backstage, thereby establishing she's already comfortable enough to micromanage all that she sees and is being done incorrectly.
And with a great foil, again, Santino Fontana. I mean, you know, what a great choice for who's running this place.
Yeah, right?
It's great.
Yeah, we had seen him in Tootsie, of course.
Yeah.
Not too long before this. And I didn't make the connection because it was just otherworldly. The way he stepped
one in. Of those guys. Yeah. I mean, he played the boy in the Fantastics. He played the prince in Cinderella, and then he plays that guy.
Right.
He's one of those actors. He just
brilliant.
Got this. He's a little bit more on the leading man side for me to be able to say he's just a character actor. But he does have that chameleon quality that is unusual in leading men.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Oh, good, they're back. One of the reasons I love Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio is because they're character actors in the guise of leading men.
You bet.
They're forcing and challenging themselves every single time at the plate with being... realizing completely soup to nuts, shoes to hat, an entity that they had not previously inhabited. Not enough can be said about his portrayal of Boise and to all the dancers and assorted backstage folks as we follow Midge's world in this environment. She then goes out to attempt to wrap up the show, and the mic is not helping. She exchanges words with the band because the cues are off. I mean, I love maintaining, let's not forget where we are,
right,
audience. Right. As much as this is a beautiful theater that, you know, we've arrived at, it's a strip joint.
Yeah.
And the band's not there because...
And the follow spot doesn't come on and the whole shebang. Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, Santino won a Tony for that Tootsie.
Yes, he did.
But all of that scene was an incredible way, in my view, of establishing an average day for her, quote-unquote, at work.
Yeah.
And then on to restaurant. Where Midge?
Is it Midge? And that's the Midge scene with her. Yeah,
Liam, played by Joe Carroll.
Yeah,
on I was gonna say a horrible, bad date, but nah, it's just a date. So many dates. One of usually the man is trying way too hard, and that is the reason there won't be a second date.
Yeah.
Because he's just trying too hard.
Now, was that a practical location or is that another one? We just built it.
You know, by season four, I feel like we built 98%. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I don't actually know, but that's a pretty safe assumption because they just stopped, especially season four was coming out of the pandemic. And not a lot of restaurants were saying, please invite 100 crew into our. And our COVID czar had created an airflow system replicating the outdoors. And by then it was determined that bastard COVID had a little difficulty clinging on to people in the outdoors.
Yeah. Right.
And so they created this outdoor flow system so that the camera crew was not wearing masks, which, you know, was kind of unheard of.
Yeah.
In when we shot this in 21.
And also, if I remember correctly, Rachel was moving around with a very large mushroom head umbrella.
Yeah, built for her.
Clear and see-through.
Built for her with a fan at the top.
Right.
That so circulated. That
her hair and makeup would remain unsoiled.
Yeah. They had us, they had the actors in masks and things. And I got us these great face shields that you wore like glasses. Yep. But for her, they said, you know, there's just too much going on.
Yeah.
Let's put her in a giant.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
See-through umbrella that came down and protected. So yeah, Midge on this bad date is she's trying, and he's trying too hard. Eventually, she excuses herself to make a call, and then has that phone call with Susie.
Yeah.
And we've talked before about phone calls on this pod, and you mentioned you're being directed by Dan in your phone call. They always had this thing where if you have an off-camera phone call, you will be there on that day, if even if you're not working in any other capacity.
Well, I was not the lucky recipient of that rule, but I thoroughly understood.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love that rule. I love that rule because I have been on a set where I did that. I came in on a day off to be off camera for somebody. And when it was time to turn it around 2 days later, the actress said, "He knows how I did it." And left.
Wow. Well, that might be more the norm, or is it 50-50?
I generally have found anecdotally, I've been lucky enough to work with people who said, "I'll be there."
Yeah. Yeah. The off camera stuff is very important. It's the phone call that created a new line in the sand that I experienced, which is you don't see the person.
Right.
It is their voice.
Yeah.
And I sometimes would say, can we use the recording of their end? They don't need to be here. I don't need to see them.
Yeah.
If you can play back their performance, let me act to that and give them the day off.
I feel like quoting to you a great story that Penn Jillette tells about his time when he was filming on Wall Street.
Please.
How about that? Is that a good cliffhanger? Come on, you appreciate it a little. I mean, I know you're not happy that the episode ended, but now you have something a little extra to look forward to. A story as told by Penn Jillette to Jason Alexander. Come on, that's pretty tasty. I love this man. I hope you do too. Write to me, my Mrs. Mazelpod at gmail.com, and let me know your thoughts, questions, follow-up, anything for Jason. He'll talk. Oh, buddy. And so he'll share with you any, he'll answer questions. Do you have them? Write them to me at mymrsmazelpod@gmail.com. All right, let's get to one of your emails now, shall we? Open up the old mailbag. Ah, yes. This one comes from Elaine Swan, who writes, "Hi, Kevin. I'm absolutely loving your podcast! ! I was feeling irrationally sad about the series ending." Me too. "It has been such a bright light through the pandemic and through the recent unexpected death of my mom." Oh, Elaine, I am sorry for your loss. My mom left us a couple of years ago, whose name was Elaine. I feel we're connected. And I'm sending you love and strength. She goes on, "Being able to listen to your conversations with your guests and learning more about the behind-the-scenes stuff feels like such a gift." Well, it's a gift to share it, and thank you for that. And lastly, Elaine says, "I'm curious about whether or not you got to keep anything from the show. Specifically, did Tony Shalhoub get to keep the romper?" He did not. I think he could have. You know what? I'm going to follow up with him. I'm certain he didn't. I'm going to follow up with him really just to give him grief about not keeping it. Yeah, they sent us some stuff, clothes, and we all sort of took stuff from the set.
I got a great suit, one of the last season suits for Moish. That's kind of schmancy. And then I kept a, which I've mentioned on the podcast, a stack of period ashtrays that reminded me of the kind my grandparents used to have. And then I got a Steiner Resort ashtray that I swiped from set. Mm-hmm. A few other souvenirs along the way. And Cynthia, who plays Mrs. Moskowitz, was so kind to frame a plaque from Moshe's office and send it to me and gift it to me. That was very, Cynthia Darlow, very sweet. All right. Thank you, Elaine Swan, for that email. And thank you all for listening. Write to me, my Mrs. Mazepod at gmail.com. Let me know. Questions, comments, suggestions. And I will read them and I will thank you for them. And next episode, of course, part two of Jason Alexander, as we continue to break down. Well, first he'll continue his, or tell his story from Ben Gillette. Come on, that was a pretty good cliffhanger. And then we'll pick up breaking down season four, episode four. Until then, I'll see you in my dreams. And please be kind to each other. Okay, closing credits time. My Mrs. Maisel Pod was created by me, your host, Kevin Pollack, research writer, producer, Jamie Fox, and our engineer, recording, post-production producer genius is Ken Plume. My Mrs. Maisel Pod is brought to you by the fine folks at Q-Code. Q-Code. Sounds like something, doesn't it? Oh, lastly, you should know, I'm told by legal to make this crystal clear, that my Mrs. Maisel Pod was not sanctioned in any way, shape, or form by Amazon Prime, nor the show's creators Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino, although I feel the need to mention I did get their blessing. Okay, good. That should save me some legal.
Everyone needs a break from the real world. That's why we played games as kids, and that's why we should play games as adults. I'm Troy Lavallee.
And I'm Joe O'Brien. And back in 2015, we started a podcast called The Glass Cannon Podcast, a show made up of comedians and actors playing a fantasy role-playing game.
And now is the perfect time to start listening because we just started a brand new story.
It's basically Lord of the Rings meets Game of Thrones meets X-Files.
Search for The Glass Cannon Podcast on your podcast app of choice. Hey, life is hard, so come play pretend with us.